This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Knowing how to speak and understand a new language can be an invaluable tool when traveling, meeting new friends, or just even to master a new skill. But it's not always simple when you're bogged down by textbooks and structure classes. That's why so many people trust Rosetta Stone. Rosetta Stone is the most trusted language learning program, available on desktop or as an app. It truly immerses you in the language you want to learn, like Spanish, French, Italian, Chinese, and more. You won't just be studying English translations. The Rosetta Stone intuitive process helps you pick up a language naturally, first with words, then phrases, then sentences. Don't put off learning that language. There's no better time than right now to get started. For a very limited time, listeners can get Rosetta Stone's lifetime membership for 50% off. Visit rosettastone.com/rs10. That's 50% off unlimited access to 25 language courses for the rest of your life. Redeem your 50% off at rosettastone.com/rs10 today.
You must remember, a kiss is just a kiss, a smile will forget.
Welcome to another episode of You Must Remember This, the podcast dedicated to exploring the secret and or forgotten stories of Hollywood's first century. I'm your host, Karina Longworth, and this is another installment in our ongoing series, Fact Checking Hollywood Babylon.
Great films of the silent years.
This isn't news. This is totally unfounded gossip.
It's a long way from Hollywood, criticized for dealing too frankly with such themes as sex and nudity.
Hollywood.
Babylon.
Over the next 2 weeks, we're going to tell two stories which Kenneth Anger intertwines in Hollywood Babylon. That of pioneering silent film comedian Mabel Normand, and that of William Desmond Taylor, whose murder in 1922 was, along with the deaths of Olive Thomas and Virginia Rappe, one of the catalyzing events that earned Hollywood its reputation as a center for sin and led to the establishment of a code of content for Hollywood films and the more careful patrolling of the off-screen behavior of Hollywood stars. Taylor and Normand were close friends. Though some reports suggest they were engaged, other reports suggest that Taylor was gay, and Normand always denied that they were romantically involved. Taylor's murder has never been conclusively solved, but Mabel was, from the beginning, linked to the scandal because she was apparently the last person, other than Taylor's killer, to see him alive. Here are excerpts from how Taylor's tale was told in Hollywood Babylon.
On the night of February 1st, 1922, someone killed William Desmond Taylor in the study of his bungalow court apartment on Alvarado Street, in L.A.'s placid Westlake District. Taylor was chief director of Famous Players Lasky, a Paramount subsidiary. Paramount, which had its hands full with Arbuckle, could now thank its unlucky stars for another scandal. The body was discovered the following morning by Taylor's Negro manservant, Henry Peavy. Peavy ran, emitting a soprano scream, waking up the other residents of the court, including Edna Previance, who immediately placed a phone call to Mabel Normand. Mabel rushed to Taylor's to retrieve a bundle of her correspondence. Paramount chief Adolph Zukor rushed to Taylor's to clean up any signs of sexual hanky-panky. When the police arrived at Taylor's bungalow later that morning, merry flames blazed in the fireplace, fed compromising papers by Paramount's top brass. Mabel Normand was poking into the nooks and crannies for the misplaced correspondence. The still eye of the hurricane was Taylor's corpse on the study floor, 2 38 bullets in his heart. There might have been some hope of solving the enigma if the Paramount bigwigs had not swooped down on the dead man's house to cosmeticize the scene. It is more than likely that significant clues were incinerated in Taylor's fireplace. And yet, the cops uncovered a cache of pornographic photographs hidden behind some scenarios at the bottom of a drawer. These whimsical portraits of the dead man in the identifiable company of several female stars confirmed his reputation as a Lothario, if not his tact. Further sleuthing in the Taylor study shook loose a letter. When the scented page fluttered to the floor, it was seen not to have been penned by Mabel. The pale pink stationery was monogrammed MMM, and eyebrows were immediately raised. Mary Miles Minter was Paramount's answer to Mary Pickford, curls and all, an embodiment of demure innocence. When questioned, Mary confirmed her ardor. At the garish, crowded funeral, a distraught Mary Miles Minter approached the bier and kissed Taylor's corpse full on the lips. She then caused a considerable stir by rising to announce that the corpse had spoken. "He whispered something to me. It sounded like, 'I shall love you always, Mary.'" Then there was Taylor's butler, Sands. He was missing. It turned out he was the director's younger brother, a dubious figure with a larcenous past, on the lam from the law. Taylor had coached him to acquire an impeccably servile demeanor, his disguise further enhanced by bleached hair. Sands, suspected for passing forged checks and possible involvement in his brother's death, had vanished, never to be seen again. The murder threw Hollywood into an uproar. The incident was particularly shattering to the film colony, since Taylor, a social figure of prominence, had been president of the Screen Directors Guild. A handsome, worldly fellow, bibliophile and supposed bachelor with a reputation as a ladies' man, he was in reality William Dean Tanner, who had vanished from his New York home in 1908, leaving a wife and daughter. It soon came out that in his Hollywood incarnation, Taylor had been carrying on simultaneous affairs with Mabel Normand, Mary Miles Minter, and Charlotte Shelby, Mary's mother. This quadrangle held all that the tabloids could desire in the way of sensation.
Anger's version goes on, and we will hear more of it next week in our episode on Mabel Normand. But here are the claims that we're going to interrogate today. Did Paramount's fixers burn evidence at the crime scene? What was the deal with Taylor's pornographic photo stash? Was the deceased director really carrying on simultaneous affairs with 28-year-old Mabel Normand, 19-year-old Mary Miles Minter, and Mary Miles Minter's mother? And did any of this have anything substantive to do with how and why he was murdered? Join us, won't you, for the tale of William Desmond Taylor. As we noted in our previous episode, in the culture of reform that had taken hold in the late teens and early 1920s, Hollywood studio chiefs were extremely nervous that the behavior of the people who made the movies would prove to be the downfall of the industry. The studio chiefs themselves, who were generally immigrants and/or Jews, were already a target of resentment and barely veiled anti-Semitism from those behind the temperance movement, who were generally Christian nationalists. At Famous Players Lasky, the fear was especially vivid, because studio chiefs Adolf Zukor and Hiram Abrams had their own scandal to hide. In 1917, while celebrating their signing of Fatty Arbuckle to a long-term contract, the two men and other executives at their studio and their sister studio, Paramount, had run up a bill of over $1,000 at a Boston brothel. 2 months later, the husband of one of these sexual service providers working that night, and the father of another, who said his daughter was just 17, extorted Zukor and the other execs with the help of the Boston district attorney. In an attempt to keep the situation under wraps, Zukor had authorized $100,000 in payouts and fired Abrams, whose idea it had been to go to the brothel in the first place. Believing his own house was now clean, or at least not conspicuously dirty, Zukor then decided to try to handpick his own man as a figurehead for the studio's position against censorship. If Zukor was able to get the whole of the industry and the government to accept his choice for the face of Hollywood's effort to regulate itself, then Zukor could, in effect, maintain control of how he himself was regulated. The perfect candidate was William Desmond Taylor, a director who had taken it upon himself already to vocally oppose censorship of the movies. His argument was that the moralists who sought to sanitize the screen were actually in denial of the way life was lived in the modern world, which Hollywood was merely attempting to reflect the way that all arts and forms of storytelling attempted to depict and interact with their given eras. A film such as Taylor's The Soul of Youth may include such sordid things as scenes set in a whorehouse, but Taylor insisted that they were only there to show how a good soul could face the temptations of the underworld and turn away from them towards a righteous life.
I'm Bobby Finger.
And I'm Lindsay Weber.
And I want to tell you about a podcast I think you're going to love.
Who Weekly is a podcast about everything you need to know about the celebrities you don't.
Does celebrity news stress you out?
Are there too many people you've literally never heard of?
Check out Who Weekly, a podcast hosted by Lindsay Weber and me, Bobby Finger.
Each episode goes deep into the biggest Who celebrity stories of the moment. And if you're still confused, we even have a weekly call-in episode where we'll answer the most burning listener queries.
Who Weekly airs twice weekly with brand new episodes on Tuesdays and Fridays. Listen and follow Who Weekly on the Odyssey app or wherever else you get your podcasts.
Taylor, blonde and blue-eyed, was a much better messenger for this defense than the industry's Jewish foreign power brokers. But his rhetoric was still controversial in an era in which all cinemas were general admission, meaning there was no mechanism for keeping children, or women who culturally were still considered by many to be highly impressionable and in need of protection, away from films supposedly intended for male adults. Meanwhile, after an incident in late 1920 at the New Catherine Theater on the Lower East Side, when someone called out fire and six children were trampled to death, some reformers were agitating to have kids banned from movie theaters entirely, which would have been a financial disaster for the studios. And this was just the sort of ledge that they hoped a spokesman like Taylor could talk everyone down from. Was Taylor himself as squeaky clean as he seemed? He fronted as a bachelor, but unlike other Hollywood ladies' men, he was rarely seen at the popular hotel bars. After his death, there were reports in big city newspapers such as the New York Daily News and the Philadelphia Inquirer that Taylor had been seen at opium dens and so-called queer places around Los Angeles. These activities may have been part of Taylor's research into such locations in an effort to bring authenticity to films like The Soul of Youth. That said, one recent book on the Taylor case makes use of an unpublished memoir by George James Hopkins Taylor's production manager, who claimed to have engaged with Taylor in what he called an affair of the heart, discreet but passionate. Whatever his orientation, at least two of the three women whom Anger claims Taylor was engaged in simultaneous affairs would deny that their relationships with Taylor were intimate, although one of them certainly wished it had been otherwise. Mary Miles Minter had been born Juliet Riley in Louisiana. Her domineering mother, now known as Charlotte Shelby, had left her husband and taken her two daughters to Manhattan, where she gave everybody new names and pushed the two young girls into show business. As armor against the child labor busybodies, Charlotte saddled Juliet with the birth certificate and identity of a dead cousin named Mary Minter. At the age of 10, the newly named Mary pretended to be 16 and allowed her mother to style her accordingly. Within a few years, the family had landed in Hollywood, and Mary had landed a major, lucrative contract with Adolph Zukor. Mary was being groomed as the second coming of Mary Pickford, but she was not exactly enthusiastic about it. She would later say she always hated acting and referred to the persona to which she had been forced to conform as a doll-faced automaton. When Mary had signed a contract with Paramount, the contract had stipulated that she must not marry in order to preserve her persona as a little girl. Mary spent her late teens and early 20s doing everything she could to violate that contract. Mary had fallen in love with the much older Taylor at age 17 when he directed her in an adaptation of Anne of Green Gables, and she was hoping he would marry her and thus give her a chance to escape her mother and the life Charlotte Shelby had trapped Mary in. People who were around them recall that Shelby openly despised Taylor and did everything she could to keep Mary and the director apart. As for why Shelby would have been so against her young daughter's involvement with the older, powerful director, maybe it wasn't exactly personal. One account of the Mary Miles Minter saga suggests this was a storyline that had played out once before. At 15, Mary lost her virginity to an older male director who promised to marry her, but who then skipped town when Mary became pregnant. Charlotte had taken her teenage daughter to get an abortion, thus protecting her reputation and her ability to earn money to support the both of them. That had been a close call, and Charlotte Shelby wasn't going to allow it to happen again. Taylor apparently didn't want it to happen either. "I can't give you what a boy your age could give you," he told Mary. Mary believed Taylor would feel differently once she became a little bit older, or if her mother was out of the picture. The fact that Taylor was the one thing standing in the way of her mother's total control over her daughter has led many to believe over the past century that Charlotte Shelby had motive to kill Taylor. Oh, and also, there was a witness who claimed she had once heard Shelby threaten Taylor that she would, quote, "blow your goddamned brains out," unless he stayed away from her daughter. At the time of his death, Taylor had a film in release called Morals, about a young beauty who escapes a Turkish harem and falls in love with the man who protects her. It seems like Taylor himself served more of a protective than a romantic role in the life of Mabel Normand. After she returned to Los Angeles from a stay in a sanitarium, which some have speculated was intended to help her kick an addiction to cocaine, Taylor visited her at her apartment one night when she received an unsolicited visit from a drug dealer. He was apparently so concerned about Mabel and her struggle to stay sober that Taylor agreed to meet with Tom Green, a U.S. attorney who specialized in narcotics cases in Los Angeles. Taylor told Green everything he knew about the use of drugs in the movie industry, a disclosure that could have inspired quite a few people to want to kill him. And there were other people Taylor had a reason to be afraid of. It's true that his former valet, Edward Sands, had not long before smashed Taylor's car and robbed him of 7 custom suits and had written thousands of dollars of checks drawn on Taylor's account. Sands had then disappeared. Sands had been a cook at the studio commissary, who Taylor had hired about a year earlier to serve as a live-in preparer of meals and all-around manservant. But Sands had discovered an uncomfortable truth about Taylor, which he revealed to Taylor's driver, Earl Tiffany, before the robbery. Sands told Tiffany that he planned to use this information, quote, "if the old man ever gets hard with me." After Sands disappeared, Taylor fired Tiffany for knowing about the crime spree and letting it happen without intervening. Weeks later, Taylor received a terrifying package in the mail. 2 pawn tickets for jewelry that had been stolen from his house, signed William Dean Tanner. This was evidence that Sands had not only robbed him, but was in essence blackmailing him, because William Dean Tanner was the name William Desmond Taylor had been born with. It was the name he had used during his first life, his pre-Hollywood life, which he had efforted to keep secret since achieving success in the movies. In 1908, Taylor had abandoned a wife and daughter to seek his fortune out west. He didn't emerge under his new identity until 1912, leaving years of his life a total mystery. Eventually, Paramount discovered that Taylor had been financially supporting a second woman with the last name Dean Tanner, a wife who had also been abandoned by her husband, who in this case seemed to be Taylor's brother. This brother was now nowhere to be found, a fact which led to the speculation that Sands may have, in fact, been Taylor's long-lost brother. Sands was never found either. On the evening of February 1st, Mabel Normand had planned to make an early night of it. She had to shoot scenes for her new film, Susanna, the following morning, and she needed rest. But after a day of shopping, she agreed to stop by William Desmond Taylor's apartment because he said he had some books to give her. Mabel arrived around 7 p.m. Taylor's valet, Henry Peavy, mixed orange-scented martinis and then left the room. While Peavy was gone, Taylor confided in Mabel that he had bailed Peavy out of jail that morning. The valet had been brought in on charges of vagrancy and lewd conduct in a public park, which some have interpreted as meaning that he was there soliciting a male date, but could also mean a lot of other things, including that he was peeing behind a tree. They talked some more, Mabel played the piano for a bit, and at around 7:35, she said she better head home. Taylor walked her outside to her chauffeured car. She said goodbye to him by planting a kiss on her car window. He waved goodbye until Mabel's car was out of sight, and then he went back inside his bungalow apartment and left the door open. He enjoyed the cool night air. Mabel was on her way by 7:45. At 7:50, Taylor's neighbor, Faith McLean, was knitting on her porch when she heard a shattering sound. She looked outside and saw a short, stocky man in a cap on Taylor's porch. The man vanished in the dark. The next morning, the whole neighborhood was awakened by the sound of Peavy screaming that his master was dead. The first arrivals on the scene were not, as Anger suggested, Mabel Normand and Adolf Zucker. They were Taylor's landlord and three neighbors and his friend, Charles Maine. Next, as word started to spread through the grapevine of Taylor's intimates, came screenwriter Julia Crawford Ivers, her cameraman son, Jimmy Van Trees, and Taylor's possible boyfriend, George Hopkins. The landlord called the police, and the first detective arrived around 8 a.m. Only after that did the first representative of the studio arrive, Zucker's manager, Charles Eiten. But once there, he jumped into action. Eiten pulled aside the many studio employees that had congregated in the apartment and asked them to surreptitiously go upstairs and collect any piece of correspondence they could find, which they did, and then Eiten smuggled Taylor's letters out of the house. For at least an hour and a half, until the coroner arrived, the assembled assumed that Taylor had died of natural causes. His body was found lying on his back, and only a small pool of blood was visible around his head. When the coroner did arrive, Eiten, as if to preclude a full investigation, announced to the examiner that Taylor had died of a stomach hemorrhage. But the coroner did his due diligence, and once he felt pooled blood underneath Taylor's body, they turned the corpse over and found the bullet hole. The angle which the bullet traveled suggested the person holding the gun had been shorter than Taylor and had been pointing the gun upwards. Taylor had been shot not in the heart, but in his left side, and the bullet had punctured his lung before getting stuck in his neck. He had been sitting at his desk, writing checks for his tax return, and it looked as though he had stood up to meet the killer, who had fired the gun at extremely close range, possibly in the middle of an embrace. Here is a good time to stop and note the many claims Anger makes about the crime scene, which seem to have no basis in fact. For one thing, Mabel Normand did not go to Taylor's apartment upon learning of his murder. If she had, detectives wouldn't have been able to find her that morning at her own apartment, which they did, and she would never again possess her letters to Taylor, which were amongst the items collected by Eiten. There was no fire burning in the apartment because there was no fireplace in the apartment. Adolf Zucker did not personally arrive to manage the sanitation of the crime scene. He sent Charles Eiten. The quote-unquote cache of pornographic photographs of famous actresses that Anger claims police found in the apartment were not mentioned in the voluminous media about the murder until Taylor's estate was put up for sale 3 months after his death, and then there was a single tabloid item claiming that the district attorney had held from the sale photos of quote-unquote young women in art poses, some of which were said to be exceedingly daring. Of the many things discussed constantly in the media, these photos were just a blip, which suggests they either didn't exist or had no bearing on the case. Finally, Taylor was not found with two bullets in the heart. He was found with one bullet lodged in his neck, which traveled from the outside of his left ribs to get there. Mary Miles Minter learned of the murder from her mother. She rushed to Taylor's apartment and displayed her grief for the reporters who had now congregated at the scene. From there, and hysterical Mary headed to the mortuary, where she exhibited bizarre behavior which seems to have been the basis for Anger's inaccurate story about her kissing the corpse at the funeral. Here, Mary reportedly offered to give blood to save Taylor. "I can lie down on the table and you can pump the blood out of me into him." When the mortician told her that this was not possible and in fact would be useless, she responded, "You don't understand. This is my mate. I have the right. I claim this man." Later, after Taylor had been embalmed, Mary returned to the funeral parlor. "I wanted to kiss him on the lips," Mary later said, "but she was too short to reach into the casket with her face. Instead, she put her hand in, and when she felt how cold Taylor was, she was disabused of any fantasy that he could come back to life." Meanwhile, detectives had shown up at Mabel's apartment to question her. There were still police in her apartment and down below on the street when a frantic Mary Miles Minter showed up. The two women went into the bathroom together and turned on the taps so that the cops couldn't effectively eavesdrop. Mary demanded to know the true nature of Mabel's relationship with Taylor. Mabel assured the much younger woman that she and the director had not been romantically involved, the same story she had told the detectives and would continue to tell throughout the rest of her life. This didn't mean that she was not crushed by Taylor's death. Mabel Normand had lost a mentor, a confidant, a best friend. She would sob throughout Taylor's funeral, where she sat next to George Hopkins, who, of course, some believe was Taylor's real, left-behind romantic partner. Because the cops couldn't hear the innocuous conversation in the bathroom, they may have taken the opening to imagine the worst. They were already starting to suspect that one or both of these women who were devastated by Taylor's death might lead them to the killer. And then the police got an anonymous letter telling them that they would find a gun just like the one that killed Taylor at Mabel Normand's house. They searched Normand's house and found two guns, both a different caliber than the pistol that had shot Taylor. Who sent the letter and what were they trying to distract away from? We will probably never know. It was just one of hundreds of false leads that the police chased in the immediate aftermath of the killing, which may have led them off the path of the truth. The newspapers, having enjoyed a circulation boost thanks to their obsessive Arbuckle coverage, rushed every bit of rumor and speculation to press as fast as they could. So the secret lives Taylor had gone to so much effort to hide, both his past identity and abandoned family, and his more recent excursions into Los Angeles's so-called queer places, were unceremoniously outed on front pages nationwide. Mabel and Mary were quickly branded as suspicious characters in the story as well. In an effort to draw attention away from the actresses, Charles Eyton had told reporters, "I know positively that Bill Taylor was not intimate with any woman." A declaration that didn't look so innocent when the tabloids got around to documenting Taylor's supposed queer affinities. Eyton made a show of collaborating with detectives, even handing over to them many of the letters and documents he had ensured had been smuggled away from the crime scene. But he held back plenty as well, including Mary's letters to Taylor, which Eyton eventually leaked to the Hearst papers. This had the dual effect of counteracting the bad press Taylor was getting for having maybe been potentially gay or bi, and it would also further diminish Mary's star power. If her studio couldn't save her from this scandal, then they would help to bury her further, so as to eliminate the problem of how to rehabilitate her. The studio exec also managed to sneak two precious bits of evidence back into Taylor's house: a lacy handkerchief monogrammed MMM for Mary Miles Minter, and Mabel Norman's letters to Taylor, which he hid in an old boot. Investigators did not find the letter from MMM that Anger describes. It was one of the items that Eitan leaked directly to the press. However, when questioned, Mary admitted that though she had been in love with him, she and Taylor had not actually been lovers. Meanwhile, Paramount attempted to change the conversation by promoting a nationwide manhunt for Edward Sands, Taylor's missing, larcenous valet slash maybe brother. The studio also put out stories about positive aspects of Taylor's character, such as his collaboration with the drug czar, which was painted not as evidence that Taylor was willing to snitch on his whole industry in order to save one woman, but instead a testament that he had been killed in the midst of a mission to clean up the debauchery that women's groups and Christians were so forcefully decrying. And still, small-town reformers around the country began insisting on the bans of Mary Miles Minter's movies and calling for Molly O., the most recent Mabel Norman film, to also be pulled from theaters. And yet both actresses continued to work, at least initially. After a brief hiatus to give her time to grieve her lost friend, Mabel Norman went back to shooting Susanna for Max Sennett, and Mary traveled to Wyoming to shoot a down-market Western. She shot two more films for Paramount, and then Paramount told the 21-year-old that they were not renewing her contract. Mary never acted again. She had a difficult time relinquishing fame, understanding that even if she couldn't act in movies, she could hold on to a certain type of celebrity by continuing to link herself to the still unsolved Taylor murder. In the late summer of 1923, Mary suddenly reversed the story she had been telling for a year and a half. She had lied when she had painted herself as a lovelorn schoolgirl with an unrequited crush on her director, she now said. In fact, she claimed now, she and Taylor had been mutually in love and sexually involved. They hadn't been open about their relationship and hadn't legitimized it with marriage, only because Mary's mother, Charlotte Shelby, was so jealous. Mother liked William Desmond Taylor very much, Mary now claimed. It was not until Mother discovered that Mr. Taylor cared more for me than he did for her that she became bitter towards him. This seems to be the basis of the rumors in Hollywood Babylon that both mother and daughter were having affairs with the deceased man. But it was most likely a lie told by an unhappy young woman who was desperate to rebel against her mother and to stay in the spotlight. 2 years later, Mary sued Shelby for withholding profits the actress had earned over her decade in the film business. Despite the inconsistencies in Mary's story, the LAPD took these new claims seriously as evidence of Charlotte Shelby's motive. They had already had their eye on her because she had no alibi for the night in question. But the DA refused to press charges at that time. When he finally ordered that Shelby be interviewed in 1927, she told an unexpected version of the story, insisting that she had never had any ill will towards Taylor. She admitted that she had owned a .38 caliber gun at the time of the murder, but she insisted her own mother had gotten rid of it. Not only did the LAPD not have a gun, smoking or otherwise, to link Shelby to the crime, but the one neighbor who had seen the killer enter Taylor's home had given a description that in no way matched Shelby. Then, in 1928, the DA who had been overseeing the case was brought down by a corruption scandal. Mary Miles Minter and family were brought before a grand jury in 1937, but this led nowhere. The case remained frustratingly open, and there was no new significant wrinkle for almost 30 years. And then... another player in one of Mary Miles Minter's last films, that Wyoming-set Western, was an actress who went by Patricia Palmer, whose real name was Margaret Gibson. Gibson had been having trouble finding work after being acquitted of charges involving drug dealing and prostitution. And then, suddenly, after Taylor's death, Paramount/famous players Lasky cast her in two movies. Gibson had known Taylor. They had acted together back before Taylor had become a director. Gibson's good luck, though, would be short-lived. In 1923, she was arrested again for extortion. This time, the charges were dropped, but her career did not recover. By 1929, she was retired from movies. She lived another 35 years, and then, on her deathbed in 1964, she confessed to killing Taylor. Though by then it was impossible to fully interrogate Gibson or relitigate the case sufficiently, her confession has been taken seriously by many followers of the case. The theory is that, given Gibson's criminal history and the many secrets Taylor was keeping, perhaps she killed him or collaborated with his killer as part of a blackmail scheme gone wrong. Then, her silence about something involving Taylor, maybe just the true identity of the killer, or maybe something else, was bought by Paramount with those few movie parts in the months after the murder. Just as the media circus around Roscoe Arbuckle made it impossible to ever understand what truly happened to Virginia Rappe in that hotel room, the media's focus on Mary Miles Minter and Mabel Normand served as misdirection, which allowed Paramount to protect all kinds of other secrets and to control the ensuing reform of cinematic content. We'll get to that later in this series. Next week, we'll back up a bit to talk about the life of Mabel Normand and how scandal effectively ended her career, although not exactly the scandal given such credit in Hollywood Babylon. Thanks for listening to You Must Remember This. Today's episode was written, narrated, and produced by Karina Longworth. That's me. Our editors are Sam Dingman and Jacob Smith. Our research and production assistant is Lindsay D. Schoenholtz. Our social media assistant is Brendan Whalen. Original music was composed for this season by Evan Viola. And our logo was designed by Teddy Blanks. Special thanks to this week's special guest, Fred Savage, who read from Hollywood Babylon. For more information about this episode and other episodes, please go to our website, youmustrememberthispodcast.com. There you'll find show notes for every episode, which include links to our sources. If you like the show, please tell anyone you can, any way that you can. You can follow us on Twitter at Remember This Pod, and we're on Facebook and Instagram too. And if you are a fan of this podcast, perhaps you'll also like my new book. It's called Seduction, Sex, Lies, and Stardom in Howard Hughes' Hollywood. It comes out on November 13th, but you can pre-order it now at Amazon.com or HarperCollins.com. We'll be back next week with an all-new tale from the secret and or forgotten histories of Hollywood's first century. Join us then, won't you? Good night.
Stole away my life for a while. Stole away my life, stole away my time, stole away my life. You're a thief with a smile. You're a thief with a smile. You're a thief with a smile.